Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 4th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, the psychology of personal change, the death of a star, and what's hotter than infinitely hot.
The ordinary temperature, the Celsius scale, you can have positive numbers, negative numbers, but you also know that there's the absolute temperature scale, the Kelvin scale, where you normally only have positive numbers. It starts at zero, it can go up all the way to infinity, but that's it. Well, it's not.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
10 years from now, will I be a much different person than the current Sarah? Will future Sarah be as different from current Sarah as current Sarah is from the past Sarah that existed 10 years before? Daniel Gilbert and colleagues looked into this question by surveying thousands of adults on the web. I spoke with him about how we continue to change despite our expectations and why we have so many illusions about the future.
In our studies, we measured the personality, values, and preferences of about 20,000 people who ranged in age from 18 to 68. And we asked them to do something pretty simple. We asked them to tell us how much they'd changed in the last 10 years and how much they were going to change in the next 10 years. What we found was that people at every age in our sample underestimated how much they were going to change in the future compared to how much they had changed in the past. It's as if people recognize that change is a process they've experienced, but now they're done.
Your study looked at how people perceive themselves in the past and how they perceive what's going to happen in the future. How did you go about studying it specifically?
Well, it's not difficult to find out how people perceive themselves in the past and the future. You just ask them. Human beings, unlike mitochondria or fossils, are able to talk and tell you a whole lot of things about themselves, and that's one of the tools that psychologists use. In our studies, we asked people to tell us about their personalities, about their values and their preferences 10 years prior to the moment at which we interviewed them, and also to predict for us how those things would change in the next 10 years. What we found was that people from 18 to 68 years old all acknowledged that in the last decade, they'd changed quite a lot. Nonetheless, they also all believed that in the next decade, they would change relatively little. And of course, most of them were wrong.
Well, how can you tell that they weren't wrong about the past and that maybe they hadn't changed that much and that their predictions about the future are right?
Yeah, so when a person who is 40 says that I've changed a lot in the last 10 years and a person who's 30 says I don't expect to change a lot in the next 10 years, how do you know who's wrong and who's right?
Right.
Well, the tools we use are pretty simple. We first compared the amount of change that people remembered experiencing in the last 10 years with a publicly available database that measures how much people actually do change over time. The MacArthur Foundation has wonderfully supplied all of us with data on how much personality changes over the lifespan. And what we find is that in our sample, when people look back and report how much they've changed in the last decade, the amount of change they report is virtually identical to the actual amount people do change over 10 years. Those two amounts are, in fact, much, much larger than the amount people expect to change over the next 10 years. So those comparisons lead us to believe that at least a good portion of the error is an error of prediction.
And how do people, say, on the younger end of your sample compare with people on the older end of your sample in terms of their predictions and their recollections of the past?
Well, you know, when we think of people who say, oh my gosh, I'm never going to change, we think of teenagers. Teenagers get, you know, mega death metal tattoos because they think they're going to like the same thing when they're 70 that they like when they're 18 years old. What we found is that this typically teenage error is also made by their grandparents. So we find that people at every age that we are able to measure show this mistake. Now, with that said, it does look like the size of this error in some of our experiments was smaller among older than among younger people. So there may be a sense in which we get a little bit wiser about the amount of change we're going to experience in the future, nonetheless not wise enough to make exactly perfect predictions.
So I'm going to ask a question that your study didn't really look into, but I'm very interested in the answer. So you found this big difference between what people think about the stability of their personality characteristics. They think, I'm set. I changed a lot in the past 10 years, but not so much anymore. What are some of the explanations for this perception about the stability of our personality?
Well, you're quite right that our data don't give us any answers about why this happens, but the rest of psychology surely does. There are at least two good reasons why we expected this error to occur, and we weren't all that surprised when we found it. First, it's pretty comforting to believe that change has stopped, that history has come to its end. Why? Well, most people are pretty happy with who they are, and the idea of changing is usually going to be change in a negative direction. Secondly, most people like to believe that they understand themselves, mm-hmm. and the idea that you could turn into somebody else entirely could be a little upsetting. So the first reason why we would expect people to show the end of history illusion is that it probably feels good to believe that change has come to a halt. The second reason is that prospection and retrospection are very different processes. The way we look into the future and the way we look into the past have similarities at both the neural and the cognitive level, but they have one important difference, which is it's easier to look backwards than to look forwards. If I ask you what you had for breakfast this morning, you don't have any trouble telling me. If I ask you what you're going to have tomorrow, you have to sit and think a little bit, because creating something in imagination mm-hmm. is harder than remembering something that really happened. Now, why is that important? Because when people are asked to predict how they're going to be in 10 years, what will your personality be like? How will your values have changed? What will your preferences be? They probably find that to be pretty hard. Now, instead of saying, gosh, that's pretty hard, I'm not sure I can answer your question, they instead mistakenly think that the difficulty they're having in predicting change indicates that change is itself unlikely.
Very interesting. So you call this the end of history illusion because people are making an error. It is an illusion. So what are some of the consequences of this type of error being repeated throughout the generations?
Well, any ways in which we misunderstand our future selves are bound to be consequential. Most of the decisions we make are not decisions about the moment, but decisions about our future. They could be as minor as, what do I want for dinner? They could be as important as, who should I marry? What career should I undertake? You know, how much should I save for retirement? All of these are predicated upon our beliefs about who we will be down the road. And for the last 15 years, my research team and I and many other psychologists, economists, neuroscientists have been studying the mistakes people make when they look into the future and try to figure out who they're going to be. This turns out to be another one of them. People mistakenly think that they're going to pretty much be who they are now. In science, we show a specific example of how this error can be consequential. So many of our monetary decisions are based on what we will want later on down mm-hmm. the road. We ask people to tell us how much they would pay right now to see the musical band that was their favorite 10 years ago, so an oldies band.
Right.
And they tell us, I think the amount they told us was approximately $80 for that ticket. If you ask people how much they would pay to see their current favorite band play 10 years from now, they say about $130. In other words, we believe that in 10 years, we will really want to see the band that we currently love, despite the fact that we know we don't really want to see the band we loved 10 years ago. And this was true of 18-year-olds, 28-year-olds, 48-year-olds, 68-year-olds.
Wow. So is there any way to combat this effect? Is there something that people might try to do to prevent themselves from disappointing their future selves?
Well, again, we don't have any data on this, but common sense steps in and fills the gap where we have none. Surely one of the ways in which we can make better decisions about our future selves is to acknowledge that our inability to forecast change, our inability to see the ways in which we will be different, probably doesn't indicate that change has come to a halt. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at other people, if you're 40 years old and you look at other people who are 50, you will probably notice they've changed a lot in the 10-year decade between 40 and 50. That's a pretty good indication that you're going to change a lot, too.
All right. Well, Daniel Gilbert, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Daniel Gilbert and colleagues write about the end of history illusion in this week's Science.
Imagine what it would feel like to touch the sun, which, as far as the human experience is concerned, is essentially infinitely hot. But what if I were to tell you that some materials can reach temperatures that are hotter than infinitely hot? And what if I were to tell you that those temperatures are below zero Kelvin? Ulrich Schneider, author of a report this week, spoke with me about the mathematical and physical reality of negative absolute temperatures and why they're important for physics and cosmology.
This research is basically about extending temperature. You all know temperature ranges. You all know the ordinary temperature, the Celsius scale. You can have positive numbers, negative numbers. But you also know that there's the absolute temperature scale, the Kelvin scale, where you normally only have positive numbers. It starts at zero, can go up all the way to infinity, but that's it. Well, it's not. In some sense, what we're doing is we're extending this to negative absolute temperatures. And the important thing to remember right away is that this is not colder than zero Kelvin. Nothing can be colder than that, but it's actually the opposite. It's even hotter than infinite temperatures. This is kind of a pretty old and classical problem, so it's nothing to do with quantum mechanics. But it's just when you look at the formulas describing temperature, you really see that the scale starts at zero, it increases up to infinity, but it doesn't necessarily stop there. In fact, what we see is that it jumps from plus infinity to minus infinity and then continues growing. So the energy of the system grows further and further and further until it reaches zero again from below.
Okay, so let's start with the basics of absolute temperature. Like you said, with the Celsius and Fahrenheit scales, temperature can be both positive and negative. But with the Kelvin scale, which we refer to as absolute temperature, zero is considered basically the lowest temperature possible. So how exactly is this property defined? What's actually happening at the molecular level to yield an absolute temperature?
What's happening is actually that absolute temperature is directly connected. It's in fact directly proportional to the average kinetic energy of the particles. So it's proportional to how fast the particles move. So if you think of a classical gas, like little balls flying around you, like the air around you, then actually absolute temperature is a measure on how fast these particles move on average, how high their kinetic energy is. The hotter they are, the faster they move. Therefore, it kind of makes sense that there should be an absolute lower limit, because at some point the particles will all be at rest. They won't move at all. And obviously, they can't be slower than not moving at all, so therefore nothing can be colder than zero Kelvin.
And so how then can we get a negative absolute temperature? How is that possible?
Well, the point is, if you now get a little bit more mathematical and think about the distribution of these energies. When you have a positive temperature, you have something that's described by a so-called Boltzmann distribution. That's just a name, but it basically just means that at a positive temperature, the atoms have different velocities. Some atoms move fast, some atoms move slow. And when you have a positive temperature, it means that the low energy states, they are more occupied than the high energy states. When you think of the ground state of zero Kelvin, then only the lowest energy states are occupied, meaning for our moving particles, they all stand still, and the higher ones are absolutely not occupied. If you now increase temperature, you put energy into the system, more and more states become occupied, even the higher energy ones, and this distribution, this Boltzmann distribution, becomes more and more flat. And actually, at infinite temperature, it becomes completely flat. All states have the same probability of being occupied, whether they have low energies or high energies. And now you can directly think of how to extend this. What would happen if you now have more particles at high energies than at low energies? And that's actually what you would get if you would take the same formulas and would put in a negative temperature. Another very intuitive model to think about this negative temperature is to think about a set of balls, normal classical balls, in an environment with a hill and a valley. The higher up the hill the balls lie, the higher their potential energy is. At a positive temperature, you would say, normally you put some hills in the valley and they sit there stable. And now you can take the system as a whole, shake it a little bit, and they will remain in the valley because that's where they are stable. And that's a normal positive temperature ensemble. And now at negative temperatures, that means that you put atoms on the top of the hills, which are already moving with their maximum possible kinetic energy. And now it's a very funny thing that happens. If you now shake this whole system, the balls will stay on top of the hill.
And that's the high energy state.
And that's the high energy state, exactly. And the reason for this is that as they already have close to their maximum kinetic energy, they cannot increase it. So they cannot roll down the hill because the potential energy has nowhere to go. Energy is conserved. It should go into kinetic energy, but if the kinetic energy is already at its maximum, they can't. So that's why the balls have no chance. They have to stay on top of the hill. And that's why negative temperature states are stable.
So you explain this mathematically, but how does one actually create a system? How did you actually create a system that is physically at a negative absolute temperature?
Well, what we do in the lab is we use the techniques that have been developed in the context of ultra-cold atoms. So the first thing we do, surprisingly, is we have to cool down the atoms a lot to like a billionth of a Kelvin or something, very, very cold temperatures. And then we put them into an optical lattice. And then they all occupy just this lowest band of this lattice. This has been used for the last 10 years to do many interesting many-body physics. One famous example that we're actually building up on is the creation of a so-called mod insulator. That's the creation of an insulating state where the particles are evenly distributed over the lattice with one particle, exactly one particle per lattice site. And in this state, the particles are kind of frozen out. They cannot move anymore. The reason for this is that these particles repel each other. They have a repulsive interaction. And then if two particles would meet on the same lattice site, then they would increase their energy. They would have to pay a lot of interaction energy, and therefore they don't do it. So we now have this state with frozen out particles, exactly one particle per lattice site. And the new trick, the new feature, what we now do, is we change the interaction from repulsive to attractive. So now the particles would love to sit onto the same lattice site because they would gain a lot of energy by doing so. But the state in which we have created this is a state with exactly one atom per lattice site, which means they never meet. And if we now unfreeze them, if we now lower the lattice again so that they can start to move again, they realize that they are now in the highest possible energy state of the system. And then it's natural for them to really like thermalize into a thermal distribution, but into a thermal distribution with negative energy. So in a nutshell, the key points are you need to have a system where you have an upper bound in energy. Then you have to create your system very close to this bound, that you have a very, very high energy per particle. And then you just have to wait. Then the system naturally thermalizes into such a negative temperature ensemble.
And what kind of atoms were you using for this experiment?
In this case, we were using ultra-cold potassium atoms, but that's actually mostly a technicality. We were using them because they do allow us very easily to switch the interaction from repulsive to attractive.
So how stable is a system at negative absolute temperature? You know, you created your system in a protected vacuum environment in a lab, but can negative absolute temperature materials actually exist naturally?
We can also create positive temperature systems in our experiment, and we see that positive and negative systems have the same stability. Our negative temperature systems are as stable as our positive temperature systems. You know, if you bring one very hot and one very cold positive temperature system in thermal contact, then what you get is you get one big system at a kind of intermediate temperature. So if you would now take several systems at several negative temperatures, they would also equilibrate in the same way to some average negative absolute temperature. The point that we have to so well isolate them from the environment is only that the environment that we have locally here around us is a positive temperature environment. It's maybe a little bit the same as with antimatter. You know, you mix different kinds of matter, they're stable. You mix different kinds of antimatter, they're as stable. But if you bring matter and antimatter together, then something happens. It's kind of similar here.
So how does this research advance your field? What's the greater significance of this work?
Well, let me answer this in two ways. Number one is the very practical engineering approach. And that is that for us, this is a new tool which really enhances the parameter space that we can probe. We have probed so far these ultra-cold atom systems in optical lattices at positive temperatures, and we have already learned a lot about things related to solid-state physics, to how electrons behave in certain types of solids, but there's many, many more things to learn. And there's also many more things that we can't access right now. And by now using negative temperature systems instead of positive temperature systems, we're kind of probing the high-energy regime instead of the low-energy regime, and we can therefore increase the range of effects that we can describe, that we can probe, that we can understand in the lab. I would say the stronger point for this work is more that, on a conceptual point of view, it enhances our way of thinking about thermodynamics. When you say something gets hotter, there's a little bit of confusion in there, because you can mean two things. It can mean, on the one hand, that you increase the energy of your system. It can also, on the other hand, mean that you increase the disorder of your system. Because on the positive temperatures, the both things go hand in hand. You increase the energy of your system, you also increase the disorder of your system. But now at negative temperatures, this turns around. If you increase the energy in the system, you decrease the disorder. The system becomes more ordered. So at negative temperatures, the connection between entropy and energy is kind of reversed. And that's a very interesting fact to think about, and it helps you to think about several aspects in a new way. So that's kind of the conceptual point of view. And if you now again look into the mathematics, you realize from thermodynamic relations, that at negative temperatures, only negative pressures can be stable. So we realize negative pressures in the lab, and cosmology also used dark energy, which they say is a solution for a negative pressure, to describe this accelerated expansion of the universe.
Right.
And it will be interesting to see whether you can get something out of this resemblance, whether you can use this to like, understand anything better, or whether it's just a curiosity.
Great. Ulrich Schneider, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ulrich Schneider and colleagues write about attaining negative absolute temperatures in a report this week.
This week's podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Audible has over 100,000 audiobooks, including physics titles like The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and The Race to Discover the Rest of Reality by Richard Panik, or books on genetics like The Violinist's Thumb by Sam Keen. Right now, Audible is offering a free audiobook download of your choice just for checking them out. When you sign up for a free trial at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you get a free book and you support the Science Podcast. If you choose not to continue the trial, you can cancel and keep the book. That address again is audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
Supernovae, or exploded stars, are crucial to the study of the universe. And, like in so many important findings, timing is everything. News writer Yadidjit Bhattacharjee spoke with me about scientists' quick discovery of a supernova and the human story behind it.
This is a story about a very special supernova that was discovered in August 2011. It was special because it was fairly close to Earth, only about 21 million light years away, which is a stone's throw in astronomical terms. And the other special thing was that astronomers caught sight of it just a few hours after it had exploded. So the story tells the tale of that discovery and the analysis and ends with an unexpected tragedy, which you will find out as we go along.
All right. So let's start at the beginning then. As you said, researchers caught sight of this supernova very early on in its explosion. So how did they lay eyes on such a phenomenon at such a key time?
What astronomers have been doing over the past 5 to 10 years is that they have been getting more sophisticated about automating the searches for interesting objects such as type 1a supernovae. The way that they do this is that they have telescopes collecting data through the night, and then they have supercomputers and algorithms on those supercomputers that sift through huge volumes of data, you know, looking at hundreds of thousands of stars in the sky and then searching through them to find the ones that might be the most interesting, such as a supernova explosion. And that's how this one was found.
And some of these algorithms were actually developed by the researchers who then found this particular supernova.
That's right. The two researchers who sort of spotted the supernova in the data, they didn't actually spot it in the sky, Joshua Bloom and Peter Nugent. Joshua Bloom was really the person who had developed these algorithms, along with many others, of course. And it was a result of the sharpness of these algorithms that these researchers had begun to find interesting objects in fairly short order after observations. And with this one, they got really lucky because it turned out to be a very special one.
And how long does it take for a star to explode? You know, how long is the window of opportunity the researchers have to really dig in and learn about this star?
A supernova, once it goes off, will actually explode over weeks and months and even years. And in this particular instance, Peter Nugent and Joshua Bloom, when they found the supernova, it had only been something like 8 or 9 hours after the explosion had begun. Now, keep in mind, though, that when I say the explosion had begun, the explosion actually occurred 21 million years ago. And the light from the explosion arrived on Earth right around August the 24th, 2011.
Right. But we already do know so much about supernovae and about these type 1a supernovae. You know, why is it so exciting to catch a supernova so early in its formation? What is the new information that we can learn in these very early hours?
Well, you're right that astronomers have been finding supernovae, and specifically type 1a supernovae, that have been burning for, you know, years. However, some of the most interesting events in the explosion happen in the first few hours, astronomers still have lots of questions about how a Type 1A supernova originates, how it detonates, and how the explosion proceeds. Astronomers know that a Type 1A supernova essentially requires that the exploding star reaches what's known as the Chandrasekhar limit in mass, which corresponds to roughly about 1.4 times the mass of the sun. And so they know, or they have pretty good reasons to believe, that a Type 1A supernova essentially arises in a two-star system where one star is dumping material onto the other star, and that star, the one that's receiving the material, ultimately acquires enough mass to set off a chain reaction within itself that leads to this detonation. So it just brought more clarity to the models that describe how Type 1As form.
And so what did these scientists ultimately find? What were the progenitor stars and how big were they?
Well, they did confirm that the star that actually exploded was a white dwarf. Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't very surprising, but it was very good confirmation of existing theory. However, the other stars, the star that is dumping the material, people have less clarity on what that star needs to be like. In this case, what they discovered was that the other star was also a small star. Perhaps it was a white dwarf. And so it just helps them to build a much clearer picture of this one single event and from that extrapolate to what other Type 1As are like.
And this research was, you know, a big enough deal that quite a lot of publications came out of it.
Yes, this was very exciting. I think there were three papers that appeared in Nature. And there have been dozens of papers already now in different astronomy journals about this object.
And that speaks to the fact that this was a really highly collaborative finding, which you really talk about a lot in your paper.
That's actually one of the really exciting things about this story in my mind, because the detection of a supernova is sort of a dramatic event. Astronomers get very excited when they hear that there's something that they can begin to observe right away, and you can sort of set up this chain of observations around the globe. And astronomers do this by sending out what's known as an astronomer's telegram. They put out word that, hey, here's the location of what appears to be a Type 1A supernova. Please go ahead and collect more data. So it sort of engenders this huge community feeling. And that's kind of a uniquely human side of astronomy. These stars are so far away, they're so remote, and yet they are bringing these scientists together.
So what eventually became of these researchers? You alluded to earlier that this wasn't necessarily a happy ending for everyone involved.
Right. It was actually quite tragic because the three researchers that I describe in the story, two of them I've mentioned before, Peter Nugent and Joshua Bloom, they went on to give presentations and talks about this discovery. But Weidong Li, who was a very important contributor who had come to this country from a farming village in China, and he was in his early 40s, everyone knew that he was this sort of quiet, brilliant astrophysicist. He ended up committing suicide on December the 12th, 2011, just as the supernova had started to fade from peak brightness. It was right as a couple of these Nature papers were coming out. It was for personal reasons that I don't think his colleagues really know about, but it was just very painful for them that such a talented young scientist was no longer going to be working with them.
But his legacy lives on in all of this ongoing supernova research.
That's exactly right. And so I guess that is the silver lining, that this last work of his, that's one of the things that he will be remembered for. And that's why I wanted to write the story.
Well, Udijit Bhattacharjee, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yudhija Bhattacharjee writes about the death of a star in a news focus in this week's issue. And that concludes the January 4th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.